The countdown is on to fight time. This is Big Fight Weekend. Now, here is your host, TJ Reeves.
Well, we are ready for a weekend that has multiple title fights, that has a Hall of Fame induction, and actually has some very interesting nostalgia anniversaries and much more. Hello, and welcome aboard to another edition of the Big Fight Weekend Preview. I am merely the somewhat competent host. He is our insider from his Fight Freaks Unite Substack. He's cooking along right now with BigFightWeekend.com as well. Hello, Dan Raphael, as we get things rolling here for another edition of the program. And I know there are special times. You are a Hall of Fame voter for the International Boxing Hall of Fame, and this is always a special weekend. We're going to get into that. But we got a bunch of different fights to preview as well as we launch into the weekend. How are you feeling?
I'm good. We got a bunch of good fights this weekend, which, you know, makes up for the, like last weekend where you just had the one card of consequence with Clarissa Shields. This week, we've got the legitimate junior welterweight championship with Josh Taylor defending against Teofimo Lopez in New York. You got Sonny Edwards in his first fights and signing up with Matchroom Boxing defending his flyweight title. We got Jaime Munguia, who I have been extremely critical of just fighting one no-hope guy after the other over the last several years. But not to say that Sergey Devrinchenko is prime for the upset necessarily, but it's by far and away his best opponent that he's fought in quite some time. So we'll get into that. Sergey's a tough dude. And even your good buddy Adrian Broner back in action on Friday night.
Dan is put on the rundown. We are going to talk about Adrian Broner. And I specified how long, and he said a couple of minutes. Okay, so that's good. That's a good compromise on that. We'll bring that up as he's in action. Also, a Showbox card as well for the weekend, depending on when you're hearing us. Again, as we launch on Thursday nights, late night into Friday. Again, the Showbox card is on Friday night. A lot of these title fights obviously happening either Saturday at Madison Square Gardens Theater, the Hulu Theater, or in the afternoon in London on the Matchroom show for the Sonny Edwards world title fight. But you can always count on us, at least for right now. We're doing the best that we can to stay current and to stay consistent, that we're here with a preview that is out heading into the weekend and then a Fight Freaks Unite recap off the weekend. And that reminds me to remind you all to rate and review the show. Find us, follow, subscribe, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us and review us, especially on Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star review. Somebody actually did rate us and review us, Raphael, and said, not surprisingly, that you are the class and the dean of insiders, but they love my Mickey impersonations from Rocky. You went and got civilized, Rock. So
it is pretty good. I got to give you props. It's not bad.
It's better than me singing, put it that way. Anyway, rate us and review us. Put that in there. It helps more people find us. And again, the audience continues to rock on. So we'll get into the fights of this weekend, the news of this week, some nostalgia that includes Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson anniversary from my hometown, Raphael, Memphis, Tennessee. And you were there for that one. But first, a little bit of a heavy heart for you and a little detour away from boxing. That's because one of the guys that you have enjoyed, especially a social media back and forth fun relationship with, and a wrestling Hall of Famer in his own right, the Iron Sheik, passed away. He had not been in great health, but the professional wrestler, the Iron Sheik, who's known for several things, arguably most known for losing the title to Hulk Hogan, but also known for the evil tag team with Nikolai Volkov as the Russian and the Iranian, but also him singing the Iranian national anthem and Volkov singing the Russian national anthem that no one could understand, is all-time classic stuff 40 years later. So we pay tribute. Rest in peace, Iron Sheik. Say a few words if you would.
I mean, first of all, one of the greatest heels, if not the greatest heel, maybe in the history of not only WWF, which is what it was called when I was growing up, or now presently WWE, or any of the various wrestling promotions that there have been over the years. A absolutely legendary heel. And by the way, before he became a professional wrestler, he was a world-class Greco-Roman wrestler of Olympic caliber when he was a younger guy. He actually was, and I didn't even know this until I read some of the obituary material on the legend, on Sheiky Baby, that he had, I guess, been an assistant coach for the United States for two Olympic teams, the 1972 United States wrestling team and the 1976 United States wrestling team. And listen, when I was a kid, 10 years old, up to maybe like 14 or 15 years old, this is in like the early 80s to mid 80s. WWF at the time was still a regional promotion. It hadn't gone yet all over the country in the way that it ultimately became. And they were the wrestling promotion of the Northeast, where I grew up. And so countless times when I was in that early age, not besides just watching the television programs, I went to the shows, to the house shows, sometimes they were televised, but usually the non-TV shows in places like Glens Falls, New York, and Schenectady, New York, and where my father lived in Poughkeepsie, New York, and went and saw a lot of those matches on a regular basis. And Iron Sheik was on some of those shows. So I saw him wrestle in person when I was a kid. But listen, anybody that's followed me on Twitter or follows the Sheik, number one, the Sheik on social media, as vulgar and the combination of vulgarity and endearingness altogether. I can't really explain it, but he's a legend, as he would say. You know, there's only one man who's Iron Sheik class. That's the Iron Sheik. So we had our online feud in quote marks. He often accused me of drinking the Sprite. I told him, I called him the mayor of Jabroniville.
I only asked this out of respect that I never understood the insult or the inside joke. Are you here to spill what exactly that meant? Was it just meaning that you're plain? What was the insult?
It was just a joke that started, actually. I don't even remember how it started, but it was something between myself and Iron Sheik and our friend Kevin Ioli, who's the boxing reporter, writer, columnist, and MMA for Yahoo Sports. So it just sort of became a thing. And also our publicist friend, Fred Sternberg. And it just sort of became like, don't drink the Sprite. I was so sad when I saw that he had passed, because he just, as back and forth as there was, every time I read his timeline or see his tweets pop up, whether it was about anything or it was him going at me, which he would just randomly do from time to time for no particular reason, just to stir things up. He made things fun, and it was like a diversion, and I just enjoyed it immensely, and sad to see him go. I mean, as I said in my tweet about his passing, at some point I will have to hoist. I'm not a big beer drinker, but in the honor of the legend, I'll tip a cold beer in honor of the late great Iron Sheik.
All right, so I'll share a few things with you about this. Number one, a lot of times in the creation of Vince McMahon or of other professional wrestling promoters, the evil heels, the foreigners, were not really from the country where they were from. Sheiky Baby was really a legit Iranian. At a time, again, when they were able to play off the whole U.S.-Iran feud that took place with the hostages and whatever, they were able to play off of this because he was a heel or a villain from Iran legitimately, and singing the Iranian national anthem with the flag. And that's the same with Volkov, with the wrestler that wrestled under the name Nikolai Volkov, also a Russian, authentic on both of those. So
I follow a lot of people and things on Twitter. I think of the, I don't know what I follow, 400 something, 300 something things. Following the Iron Sheik is probably the most fun thing there is to do.
Highly entertaining. So I remember seeing them at a house show that was not televised in Tampa. I say that it was not televised. I don't think the whole card was televised because they were wrestling a couple of nobodies, and that may have been the televised part of it at the what's now known as the Yingling Center on the campus of the University of South Florida. They would wrestle there all the time. What was the Sun Dome, where the likes of Hulk Hogan, Macho Man, Randy Savage, all of those guys, the WWF.
That's the same here. I covered a Keith Thurman fight at that building.
That's correct. You and I were in the building. You and I were in the building that night. We just didn't know each other yet in 2015 and around the media area for Thurman Collazo.
Yes,
back
sir.
July 2015, but they would wrestle at the Sun Dome probably once every 90 days. The WWF would come down here, and the Sheik and Volkov had the tag team titles, but they were wrestling a couple of nobodies, and I think they were doing it on TV. I remember it was one of those. I went there two or three times to see them, the WWF, and so sometimes it was full television where, all the all the lights are on and you could see Vince McMahon and Bobby Heenan doing the commentary one time. But then there were other times when it was darkened in the arena and they were actually wrestling a different match, or maybe the Sheik was wrestling as a solo wrestler, let's say, for example, and it was not being televised. It was only there for the card and for the buildup. But I remember he and Volkov very vividly with the belts. This is probably 84 or 85, wrestling a couple of nobodies, nondescript, seeing them, and the heat, as the wrestlers describe it, the crowd, the anger, either the cheering or the anger, the heat was palpable on hating those guys, and the Sheik loved it and loved playing it up. So that's one thing that I would say in addition to him being Iranian, but there's another thing coming. Go ahead.
I think we need to get on to the boxing, or I'll have to put you in the camel clutch.
I understand that, but one more thing. One of the all-time breaks of cover ever is when they caught the Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan in a traffic stop with drugs in the car, and it came out that they were riding together and they were buddies. That was a big subplot and controversy around there with the Iron Sheik, but it came around after that. So yes, RIP to the Sheik and the camel clutch forever. All right, so good stuff. Let's get into the fights, and we will kind of go chronologically. All right, so first of all, you obviously have done some work with Fight TV that's out there on a freelance basis on your many endeavors for this Adrian Broner fight card that is Friday night in Miami. Broner and Bill Hutchinson, who is literally a lawyer by trade in addition to being a boxer. All right, give me a little preview here, because Broner's a multi-time divisional champion. I will ask this on behalf of the audience. Why should we care about this? Legitimately, why should we care about this? Go ahead.
Well, it's not a matter of, I mean, there's lots of fights that are much bigger that some people care about, some people don't. Broner has a certain fan base. There's no doubt about it. Whether you love him or you hate him, he's been one of the biggest names in the sport for a number of years. As far as my involvement with Fight, I've known those guys and done some work with them here and there over the years. For this particular event, they did a sort of a preview show, but instead of running it as the full show on Fight on the app like they often will do, they took it and they cut it up into a variety of different spots to use on their social media. And it was, I was hired to do a thing with Don King, who was the promoter of the fight. Obviously, he's now has signed Adrian Broner. So, you know, I've known Don for a long, long time. And we did an interview, and that's been what they've used for some of the promotion of the event. But just for the record, it ain't like anybody at Fight or anybody at Don's office said anything to me about, you know, what to ask. That's all, you know, I ask what I want to ask. I would never take the check from somebody if I couldn't ask what I wanted to ask. In any event, no, why do they care about Broner? Look, he's a four division world champion. He's had a lot of struggles. At one time in his career, he was obviously on a people's pound for pound list. That's a long time ago. And I think everybody loves a reclamation story, a rebound, a recovery, whatever it is. And I don't know if he's going to do anything with this opportunity, but he has an opportunity. I look at this like this, TJ. He's a guy that was basically, you know, left PBC and Showtime. I don't think they were like worried about that. They're sort of like, don't let the door hit you on the way out kind of situation after he had layoffs and problems and then pulled out of a fight on less than a week's notice. He said it was for mental health reasons.
Been in jail a couple of times in Cleveland.
He's been in jail several. Yeah, he's had a lot of financial problems, jail problems. I mean, you know, weight problems, you name it. I mean, he's had those problems. And at least he admits it. Okay, so that's one thing. And the other thing about it is, after that situation where he left Showtime and PBC, he signed with Fanfare this 3-fight deal with BLK Prime, which then went nowhere because they couldn't deliver anything for him. No surprise there, and they're basically done anyway. And he was looking for a landing spot, somebody to give him a chance. And lo and behold, here comes Don King, who in the twilight of his career at age 91 and without any real discernible talent in his stable or top names or anybody he could build a show around, he figured, like, you know what, let me give the kid a chance and maybe the two of us can ride back into some kind of prominence together. So again, I'm not advocating the show. It's, you know, if you want to buy it, fine. It's like a $25 pay-per-view. It's whatever. It's actually some okay stuff on the undercard. But Broner is a name and some people are interested. So he's fighting Bill Hutchinson, who, like you said, he's a club fighter, but an attorney by trade. He's talking a good game. He hasn't lost in 7 years, even though he hasn't fought anybody of consequence. And the hilarious part is they're making jokes about the whole lawyer thing, you know, whereas Don King is saying, you know, Adrian Broner, you know, has always, you know, had never had a problem, you know, dealing with lawyers for his legal problems. And, you know, he said, and Broner saying, well, now that I know you're a lawyer, you know, I might need a good lawyer. So after I know you'll put up a fight against me. So after I beat you, I know you'll put up a fight for me in the courtroom and I'll hire you. And it was just very, it was in all in good fun and all in good humor. So listen, I'm not advocating. I'm simply saying, let people know Adrian Broner, who had a huge following and was in some big fights and was on the premium cable networks, HBO and Showtime for a lot of years. He's back in action on Friday night, and that's that.
There you go on that one. Likewise, the Showbox card on Friday, while we just go chronologically, we'll have a couple of light heavyweight showdowns. Ali as Mailoff in the main event against Charles Foster. And then a guy that we got to talk to a little bit on Thursday as we released the podcast, and a very lively personality. Richard Van Sicklin is his name. He's a fighter out of Seattle, Washington, grew up on the West Coast. And what a story, Dan Rayfield. He's in the co-feature fight on Showbox, in and out of homeless shelters, and then later gets to college, got a college degree, and that's where he picked up boxing, at the University of Washington in Seattle. Richard was very personable. We've written about him a little bit on the site as we released the podcast here. He's in the co-feature fight. And I brought up to him, there's opportunity for both of these guys, for anybody in these two fights, because there are not a lot of prominent American light heavyweights right now. So we'll see what happens in the Showbox card that's in and around the Hall of Fame weekend setting. I know you've touched on that. That'll be a Friday night card.
Right. The fights are taking place at the Turning Stone Resort Casino in Verona, New York, which is literally like about 10 minutes down the highway from the Hall of Fame in Canastota. But the induction ceremonies, for many years, the induction ceremonies took place at the Hall of Fame in front of the building in this big open area. Last year, because they had this huge class of three classes at once because everything was delayed because of COVID. And now again this year, they're doing the actual induction ceremonies in the arena that's at the Turning Stone, where I have covered several fights over the years. So the activities will take place in the same spot where the boxing matches are Friday. They try to do a show around the Hall of Fame every year. And I am interested in the card from the standpoint, not so much specifically for the fight that you mentioned with the Van Sicklin in the co-feature, but the main event, the other light heavyweight, that's the so-called A side, if you will, but I guess they're both A sides because they're both undefeated. Mm-hmm. And that's Ali Ismailov, who is 10-0, a 30-year-old. He's from Russia. He lives in Detroit. He's part of Salida Promotions, where Salida has a number of Russian fighters that have based themselves out of Detroit. He is fighting in the main event against Charles Foster, who is 22-0 with 12 knockouts, from Connecticut. And they're one guy, you know, Ismailov is 30, Foster is 33. So they're not young guys. If they're going to do something, it's time to get a move on. And it's sort of like the winner of the fight, it seems to me, is going to have an opportunity to really step up into a bigger fight. Because like you said, there's not a lot of prominent American light heavyweights presently. I guess the most, unless I'm missing one, I guess the most prominent, I guess, would say is Joe Smith, who's been out of the ring for year now, since he got beaten by Better Be Up in their unification fight last June. So there's a chance. And look, light heavyweights, sometimes they can provide a lot of good action. It seems like these guys are the types of fighters that, you know, I think will come forward and hopefully make a good fight. And even if I didn't know that, just knowing the way that Showtime and Gordon Hall, who runs the series, go about trying to match these fights, particularly on a big weekend like the Hall of Fame weekend, where there's gonna be a lot of boxing folks around, you know, at the fight, et cetera. They want to put on a good show. And so, you know, I always love Showbox cards, and this is a pretty nice one, if you ask me.
And again, Van Sicklin, because we talked to him, is 29. So again, to your point, he's not a spring chicken either. They got to get going. These guys know that right now at this point in their career. So let's see.
And he's taking on another undefeated fighter, Juan Carrillo, who is 30 also. He's a 2016 Olympian from Colombia. So, you know, they seem like pretty solid matches to me. I mean, we'll find out on Friday night after I watch them. But, you know, not, I got to be honest, not every Showbox like catches my fancy. This is a card that I looked at. I'm like, you know what? I'm actually want to see these two
and
fights.
What are they up to? They're up to over 50. Is it over 70? Is it over 75 future world champions that have fought on that series over the last 21 years? It's a ton that eventually.
It might even be more than that. I mean, they like to, you know, they always advertise it in their press announcements, and I know they keep track of all that, but suffice it to say, there is dozens of fighters that went from being on Showbox as prospects to becoming future world champions. There's numerous guys on that series.
Love that. All right, and we'll get more into the Hall of Fame, which the induction again is on Sunday as they lay it out, because there are fight cards this weekend, including one in New York. Let's get to that. Highly anticipated now as we get to the weekend, Josh Taylor defending the WBO version of the 140-pound title. Used to have all the belts.
He's the lineal champion. That's the bottom line.
But he used to have all the belts, and then he said discard. He in the last year has now discarded three of them, still has the WBO title, and he will take on Teofimo Lopez, former unified champion at 135, in a very intriguing fight. Again, Hulu Theater adjacent to Madison Square Garden for this main event, top rank ESPN main event. All right, give me some more as we build towards this, as we release the podcast and get ready for Saturday night in New York.
I mean, it's an excellent matchup. They're both guys who have shown, you know, great talent and great ability to have some big wins on their record. But they also are both two fighters that enter this fight with a lot of question marks around them, which is sort of what makes it interesting. Like, if they fight if they're at their best that we've seen them at in the past, you know, it could be a really dynamite fight. Now, of course, Teofimo has made his name as a lightweight, not as a junior welterweight. He's only had two fights in the junior welterweight division, and they were not the kind of fights where you would necessarily want to so-called write home about them. He had the debut in the weight class, which was August of last year, against Pedro Campa. Now, he did stop Campa, kind of a journeyman-ish type of guy. Didn't look great, but looked good enough. You know, he was coming off an injury, coming off a long layoff after he had lost the lightweight titles in that fantastic fight with George Kambosos in the big upset. But he got the win under his belt against Campa. His next fight took place in December in New York also. That was more of a struggle. He got knocked down in the second round. He ended up winning a decision against Sander Martin. He won a split decision. It was an awfully close fight. He was so emotional after that fight, talking in the ring to nobody in particular, do I still have it anymore? Mm-hmm. He was so fragile after that fight mentally that his team and Top Rank would not let him come to the press conference, as though we were going to somehow, you know, ask him nasty questions that would, put him further into a hole. In any event, he didn't show up at the press conference. I mean, I got to tell you, I've covered boxing a long time. Unless a guy's got an injury, I don't remember there ever being a guy that was the winner not coming to a press conference. So take that for what it's worth.
Strange.
So he's got a lot. He's got a lot of proving to do, because
he's admitted, by the way, he's got other personal problems. He's now divorced since then. So there are a lot of question marks about him between the years going into this fight, no doubt.
But the thing about it is also, if Teofimo is at his best, which we've seen him look absolutely spectacular against fighters like Richard Comey, who he starched in two rounds also in New York to win the first of the lightweight belts he won. We saw he looked the way he looked when he had the big upset against Vasily Lomachenko to win in their unification fight that took place, you know, in the bubble back in during the pandemic in October of 2020. So if the Teofimo Lopez that fought the way he did against guys like Richard Comey and Vasily Lomachenko, and obviously several of the other fighters that he was blowing out of the water, you know, who are pretty good fighters like Diego Magdaleno, who he destroyed, and, you know, Mason Menard with the one punch knockout. And, you know, even though it was a struggle, a very solid win against Masayoshi Nakatani, that was in the elimination fight, like, that Teofimo Lopez, you know, is the real deal. And with Josh Taylor, you know, you ask, so now Teofimo goes into his third fight in this weight division. He is the mandatory challenger from the WBO, and he's taking on Taylor, who is undefeated at 19-0, coming all the way from Scotland to do this fight. He has a tremendous resume, and there's a reason why most people have had him as the number one guy in the weight class for a while. You know, go back before he was a champion. He had beaten a guy like Victor Postol when Victor Postol was still really, really good. He was then in the tournament, the World Boxing Super Series. You know, kind of got an easy win against Ryan Martin in that first round of that tournament, but then he won the IBF title in a very good performance against Ivan Baranchik, who was always in good fights, who was undefeated at the time that they fought. And then he got into the final, and he met the undefeated Regis Prograis. They put on a fight of the year caliber fight. Josh Taylor won a majority decision. You know, there are some that would say, you know, hey, if that fight was in the United States or it was not in his, you know, in his backyard in the UK, maybe Regis gets the win. But whatever it was, I mean, I don't consider that to be some kind of like hugely controversial fight. It was just a tremendous fight, super close, and Josh got his hand raised. So that was a great win for him. He had a little bit of a layoff because of the pandemic. So when he came back, he had this extraordinarily unworthy mandatory from Thailand, who he just pummeled in one round. But then he came to the States. I mean, so he's kind of a road warrior in that respect. And that was to meet Jose Ramirez, who had the other two titles at the time when Josh had the other two belts. And they fought for the undisputed championship. And he scored two knockdowns against Jose Ramirez in an otherwise dead even fight. And when it was all said and done, he wins unanimous decision, 114-112 on the three cards. The difference, obviously, from a victory and a draw was those two knockdowns. And so he's riding high. He's undisputed. It's like a big deal in Scotland where he's from. You know, his idol was Ken Buchanan, who had done it as a lightweight, you know. So he enters sort of Scottish boxing history and the lore of the great fighters from Scotland. And so he then had his one of his mandatories to do in the WBO, which was against Jack Catterall, who was an undefeated British fighter. They put on that fight in February of last year. And then sort of the shit hit the fan, so to speak. He won a split decision. It was a razor close fight, but he got the call, and it became a – if you think that people thought that, like, Lomachenko and Haney was controversial, this was off the charts. Like, the British fans and media went absolutely hog wild on this
one. By the way, my hands up from a distance. I thought Catterall won that fight. He also knocked Taylor down. There were some controversial points taken away from each fighter by our friend, the referee, Marcus McDonald, who always seems to
get a little messy in there.
It was messy, but I thought Catterall won that fight. And Taylor came out of that fight with a lot of people saying, you didn't beat him. And right. then the tango started with, is there going to be a rematch? And well, the problem is the tango's like 15 months and counting, Rayfield.
Well, so what happened was and this always drives me crazy about boxing fans. And it, you know, it happens oftentimes. Josh Taylor was not the judge of the fight. Jack Catterall was not the judge of the fight. Those two guys went in the ring and did their job. They fought the best that they could. And so whatever the result is, no blame should be cast on either boxer. But unfortunately, people take their ire out on the guy that gets the win that maybe they don't think he deserves the win. So Jack Catterall took a lot of criticism. Okay, so he didn't maybe have his best fight, but it's not like he was the guy filling out the scorecards after each round. So I always get annoyed when fighters get dumped on by fans or media for that matter because of things that are out of their control. So I, in my career, I'm proud to say, you can go and search my archives for 23 years of everything I've ever written. I've never taken a shot at a fighter for a controversial decision and somehow blame them for the result. You know, talk to the judges about that. But the bottom line was he was so affected by that, that he wanted the rematch. So, you know, that was the reason why he ended up vacating or being stripped of the three other belts, because they had other he had immediate mandatories in other organizations. He was like, no, I don't want that. I want to take on Jack Catterall in the rematch make sure that I prove that I really did deserve that win. And also, by the way, because of the controversy of the other fighters that were available for him and those other mandatories, the Catterall fight from a financial perspective and a high profile perspective was clearly the biggest fight. They had multiple deals to make the fight. There was a lot of things that happened. Both guys had injuries. There was, I think, a COVID-related situation. There was like a logistical thing in terms of the date where they had to move it because of Sky, and it got postponed several times. And then the last draw was when Josh suffered a injury to his foot, and it was going to put the fight off another month or two. And at that point, this is going back, late last year, earlier this year, and the WBO stepped in and said, listen, we've given you a lot of rope on this. Enough is enough. And they called the mandatory against Teofimo. I guess it must have been early this year, because when Teofimo defeated Sander Martin in the fight we just mentioned a few minutes ago, that was the elimination fight. So Teofimo becomes the mandatory, and tired of waiting for that title to be active, they ordered that fight. So he goes, instead of fighting the rematch with Catterall, who then switched promoters, he's now with Matchroom, whatever. Now we have Catterall doing his thing, and we've got Josh Taylor coming back to the United States to fight Teofimo Lopez in New York, which is where Teofimo was originally from. And it shapes up like a really interesting fight between two excellent fighters, both whom have a lot of questions. Is Josh Taylor as good as we think he is, the way he looked when he beat Jose Ramirez or Regis Progre, or, you know, blew out the mandatory from Thailand? Or is he going to struggle again when he didn't look so great against Jack Catterall? And now he's had, you know, a year and a half off, because that fight against Jack was in February of last year. So he's coming off a tremendous layoff. He's been, he had talked about maybe going to welterweight. Maybe there's a weight issue. Who the heck knows? And then you got Teofimo, who has been more active, fair enough, but he's got two fights where he looks particularly great. And before that, he got beaten in a very brutal, harsh, difficult fight of the year kind of fight against Kambosos. So there's a lot of question marks about Teofimo also, especially now that he's not as a lightweight anymore, but now he's fighting at 140 pounds. So two guys who've been among the best out there for the last several years, but both with a lot of questions. And I think that leads to a highly intriguing fight.
And by the way, I'll just interject this. I know what you meant with all of what you said. Catterall got screwed out of this whole thing, because the hemming and hawing with where's the date, what's the fight, and then the champ gets hurt, and then the champ suddenly decides, okay, I got to go fight a mandatory and fight somebody else. Yeah, I can appreciate where he's frustrated at this point because he's wanted a rematch for over a year instead of.
I think Catterall had an issue also. Catterall, I think
he may have been. Yeah, and he may have been, but he was ready to go earlier this year, and they were supposed to have fought earlier this year.
But that wasn't Taylor's fault though. That was, you know, there was one of the times when it got postponed.
I believe I'm correct. The recent time is a Taylor foot injury, like you said, yes, which put it off earlier this year, or they would have fought. And now before, Taylor fights somebody else.
But before that, it wasn't an injury or anything to either fighter. It's because the broadcaster in the UK, which was going to pay a lot of the freight, which was Sky, they decided there was some other fight that was being postponed, and they opted to do that fight instead of the other fight, and they pushed off the Taylor and Catterall rematch. So there's, you know, it's one of those deals where it's not the kind of thing you're going to blame anybody. It's not the boxer got injured. Maybe one of the boxers, I forget if it was, there was one that was a COVID, then there was a network thing. I mean, it's just one of those things where it was sort of like snake bit. And listen, at the end of the day, hopefully down the road, you know, whatever happens in the fight on Saturday and whatever happens with Catterall going forward, he did just come back on his first fight with Matchroom and get a victory in the last couple of weeks, that someday, you know, whether it's at 140 or at 147 for a title, not for a title, just because there is that question about who should have rightfully won, that they can at some point in their careers before they're done have a rematch. But in the meantime, it's more important right now. The big fight is Josh against Teofimo Lopez, and it should be a good fight.
All right. It should be some kind of atmosphere. Real quick on the undercard, Xander Zayas is there. And what else on this undercard, Top Rank Saturday night in New York?
Yeah, well, Xander Zayas is in the co-feature. He's in an 8-rounder. You know, and the reason, one of the big reasons that the fight's in New York is because this fight is on Puerto Rican Parade Day weekend. And obviously the main event, one guy from Scotland, one guy whose background, you know, he's American, but his background is from Honduras, which is where he represented for the Olympic Games. But Xander Zayas, he's the Puerto Rican star in waiting. He's undefeated. So they wanted to kind of have him and have some of his people have something to come out. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with the parade in New York now that I think about it, given all the craziness with the air quality of what's going on, as everybody knows, in the East Coast. You know, we've got a terrible air quality here down in Virginia where they're canceling all the outdoor activities for the schools and all that kind of business, but it's the same in New York. But the bottom line is
the belief as we release the podcast is it will be better Friday afternoon, Friday night, according to the weather people, and especially by Saturday, that a lot of it is allegedly supposed to. I'm just giving you a meteorological update if you're in the Northeast and listening to us. It's allegedly supposed to be better as Friday turns to Friday night and to Saturday. So maybe they can have it. We don't know that is your point right now.
Yeah, but the Xander is on the card for that reason, because the Top Rank people and the Madison Square Garden people view him, rightfully so, at 15-0 and a very young man, as having the ability in the future. You know, he's only 20 years old, Xander Zayas. I mean, he's a tremendous young talent. That this is his first time fighting on the Puerto Rican Day weekend. It's an important deal for him and for his people. And so he's taking on Ronald Cruz, which is a little bit of a step up for him. That's the co-feature. That'll be the second fight featured on the ESPN broadcast. Obviously, everything is on ESPN Plus. And then we got some of the other Puerto Rican prospects. A kid like Henry LeBron is on there. Another Puerto Rican fighter. They have put him on the show. They have another kid named, an undefeated fighter named Omar Rosario, who is 10-0 on there. So he's on there. So they're featuring Top Rank, some of their undefeated and up-and-coming Puerto Rican kids. But there's other good prospects on it also. Bruce Shushu Carrington, who's a New York fighter, a featherweight. This kid is, if you were ranking like the top prospects at Top Rank beyond Jared Anderson and Xander Zayas and Keyshawn Davis, you would definitely have Bruce Carrington on that short list, no doubt about it. He is 7-0, was a good amateur, a dynamic kind of fighter. So there's a lot of talent on the card. You got Jermaine Ortiz coming back off of his loss against Vasily Lomachenko. This is the first fight of the deal that he did a co-promotion now between his promoter, Jimmy Birchfield, and Top Rank. So he's back in action. Robinson Conceição, the 130-pounder, former world title challenger, twice against Oscar Valdez and Shakur Stevenson, Olympic gold medal winner. He's on the card. So, you know, there's a lot of talent on the card, but the only two fights on the main ESPN broadcast are obviously the world title fight and then Xander Zayas. But a lot of talent on the show, and I always enjoy watching the way that Top Rank brings along its prospects, courtesy of the matchmaker Brad Goodman, who goes into the Hall of Fame. We'll talk about the Hall of Fame a little bit later in the show. But yeah, that's the Top Rank card. So I look forward to checking it out.
We are looking forward to that. And again, it's in the Hulu Theater, and it should be quite an atmosphere in there, especially with Zayas fighting in the co-feature and then Teofimo in the main event. Let's move along, and we do have some news and some nostalgia before we're done. We're not done yet, though, with the intriguing fights. Let's swing all the way out to Ontario, California, where Saturday night, the Golden Boy main event is Jaime Munguia, the former WBO 154-pound champ, the former number one ranked contender by the WBO for over 2+ years, who never fought for the WBO title. Here we go, and I see you shaking your head with career mismanagement. So now this is actually a super middleweight fight with Sergey Derevyanchenko. That's the main event. So it's as you said at the top of the podcast, it's a bigger name that he's fighting, but the overarching theme is the mismanagement of Munguia to this point, finally fighting a reputable name. And can we finally get him in the ring against a world champ if he's victorious, like we expect that he will be in this sometime in our lifetime?
Well, I mean, listen, I hope so, because he's a good fighter. He's very exciting. And the thing that just blows my mind about the way they've handled his career, when I say they, it's, I mean, part of it's on the kid, because, you know, he's a grown man. He's got the ability to have his opinion, but he's got two promoters in Golden Boy and Zanfer Promotions. You know, he listens a lot to his trainer, Eric Morales, the great Hall of Famer. And for whatever reason, they've been reticent to match him solid. I mean, it's really kind of shocking to me, because, okay, maybe he's not like pound for pound material, but the dude can brawl and fight. He's got a chin. I mean, he makes great fights. He's got a certain fan base. And, you know, as a junior middleweight, when he won his world title back in 2018, like, he didn't fight great opponents, but he won the title from Saddam Ali. That was a legit win. Ali was coming off the victory against Miguel Cotto. He beat Liam Smith, which is now even, that was a good win at the time. It looks even better now, given what Liam Smith has been able to do in the last few fights. And, he had a couple other defenses in there. And, okay, so things were moving along,
no,
right?
No doubt. Trajectory was up.
Yeah,
and exactly. Now it's like we're in a nosedive, baby. What are we doing?
So he goes up to middleweight in 2020, and ever since then, he's fought one guy with no prayer after another. So Gary Spike O'Sullivan, no prayer. Now, Turiano Johnson was the one guy that was like at least a solid professional. He had a lot of injury problems and never really got to the promised land, but he was an Olympian. He was, you know, he had a lot of injury issues, but he was a pretty good fighter. So I won't even knock him for that. That at the time seemed to me like a pretty reasonable matchup. But ever since then, you know, Zaremeta, who has been smoked by Triple G, who was never belonged in the fight in the first place, you know, all due respect to our good friend Gabe Rosado, but that was not a real fight. It was a complete mismatch. Demetrius Ballard was undefeated, but untested. He got smoked in 3 rounds. British journeyman Jimmy Kelly, pathetic match. Gonzalo Gaston Correa, even more pathetic match. That was his last fight in November. Now, finally, And then they make all this stuff about, like, calling out Charlo, and we're calling out this guy, and we're calling out Canelo, and we're calling out Triple G. And give me a break. Fucking fight a real guy. So, okay, those guys, for whatever reason, didn't want the fight, didn't take the fight. I don't really blame them. Charlo's been out for 2 years. That doesn't even fight at super middleweight. You know, Canelo calls his own shots. He's the champ. Triple G is basically, in at least I refer to it, as semi-retirement. They did actually call Triple G's people about their interest to make a fight for this particular slot. That obviously did not come to pass. So now you look around, who's out there that we can make a fight with reasonably, that at least is a step up, who's a good fighter, who has some name recognition? And that's where Derevyanchenko comes in. So now they're both going from 160 to 168. So it's not like a benefit for either guy. They've both been middleweights, and instead now they're fighting at super middleweight. So I don't see there being any kind of super cries out because it's unfair because of the size advantage or disadvantage. Derevyanchenko, it's a step up. That's the truth. Is it a top guy? No, he's not a world champion. And we've discussed this in the past. I respect Sergey Derevyanchenko. He should have had his hand raised that night against Triple G and won the middleweight title at Madison Square Garden. A fight that I was at, it was a great fight, fight of the year candidate. But he didn't get the win. He's got 4 losses. There are 3 of them are in world title fights, all in close call decisions. And he has another loss that was on a title fight, but to Carlos Adames, who was a 10-rounder, who now is the interim WBC middleweight champion, and I think eventually probably will be elevated, you know, because who knows what's going to happen with Charlo. But the point I'm making here is this, and I've said this before about other fighters. I'm always skeptical about guys whose reputation is built on losses.
That's correct.
Solely built on losses. Derevyanchenko doesn't have a single win on his record against a top guy, but what he does have is a highly competitive loss to Danny Jacobs in a fight where it could have gone either way. He has the loss that he probably should have won against Golovkin. He challenged Charlo, Jermall Charlo, for the middleweight belt, gave him a great fight in 2020, has the majority decision loss against Adames. So he's got these close losses, but at some point you've got to
get they're all losses. Amen. They're all losses. Yep.
But it is a step up for Munguia. He does come to fight. He has been involved in some exciting fights that have been highly entertaining, the Triple G fight being the one that's most memorable. Even the Charlo fight was a heck of a fight also. So if Munguia is not fighting the top elite guys, at least he's fighting a recognizable opponent who's got a body of work that is solid against good opposition. And hopefully, if Munguia wins, we will see him in a real a bigger fight against a better name. And if Devonchenko happens to get the win, great upset for him. Good for him. You know, he's a very likable guy and has had some hard luck losses, like I mentioned. And I suspect, by the way, Munguia and Devonchenko has got a chance to be a really good fight. So it may not be a world championship fight. It may not be the biggest names of all time, but I think that's got a heck of a chance to be something that we'll be talking about on the recap podcast is, hey, that was a hell of a fight.
All right. We'll find out again. That's the main event, Golden Boy, later in the evening. Main event, probably somewhere around main event time of Taylor and Lopez. We give or take how long the undercard takes, because again, that's in the West on Golden Boy.
The Taylor Lopez one, that's pretty easy to figure out. The ESPN main card broadcast is at 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. And the first fight is an 8-rounder, and they'll type it up. And if it goes the distance, you got to figure Teofimo and Josh are in the ring about 11 o'clock. You know, if the opener is an 8-rounder and it doesn't take that long and they're going to do their preview stuff, and I'm sure they're going to do a nice segment on Timothy Bradley going in the Hall of Fame, who obviously is not going to be there because he's going to be in Canastota for his induction ceremony. And then, as you mentioned, the Munguia card, that's on DAZN. They get on the air at 9 o'clock Eastern time, and they've got a 4-fight card altogether. So there'll be 3 preliminaries that you'll see, and then, you know, back it out. I mean, yeah, unfortunately, they're going to probably be around the same time. That's life.
If the undercard fights for Golden Boy go a little longer because there's more of them, it will be later. And if I'm remembering correctly, the Rocha main event was well after 9 Pacific time, well after midnight Eastern time in California just a couple of weeks ago. We'll see. We'll see when the Munguia on the timeline fight takes place, but
the way I will handle things is the priority is Taylor Lopez. No, it's not a knock on Munguia, but that's the real junior welterweight title.
World champions in that fight.
And there could be a non-title fight that is just a much better fighter, much bigger names than if it was a world title fight. I'm not basing it solely on the names or the titles, but in the case of Taylor and Lopez, it's the real title in that weight class. And they're two of the top guys. And in the case of the other fight, I'm interested in the fight. I think it's going to be a good fight, but it pales in comparison in terms of significance. So I'm rolling with the world championship fight. That's what I'll pay attention to on that night. And I will certainly make it a point to watch the Munguia fight as well. And I'll get to that when I get to it. Now, if we get somehow we get lucky and they don't somehow overlap, then that's just a bonus.
All right. One more championship fight to talk about, then we'll get to a little Hall of Fame and a little nostalgia before we're done. Sonny Edwards, the IBF flyweight champion, and Andres Campos, who I do not know a whole lot about. That's a good one-liner comeback. This is the main event of the Matchroom show earlier in the day, U.S. time, prime time in London. Edwards, again, has got some flash. He's good on the mic. He's not a big-time puncher. Give me a little more on this from earlier in the day on our timeline.
Well, first of all, you said, you know, about his opponent, Andres Campos, who was 15-0 from Chile. I'd be lying if I said I knew a lot about him. I know a lot about a lot of fighters. He's not a guy that I'm that familiar with. But they're both undefeated. Sonny is 19-0. He's an excellent boxer. As you described him perfectly, he's got a great gift for talking on the mic and hyping his stuff up. But he's more of a boxer than a puncher. Obviously, he's a very technical fighter. And he's defending his flyweight title. But the key here is this. He just signed with Matchroom. He was, he was one of the guys that was with, I guess, ProBellum that became free after all that business went out, you know, after MTK went out of business and then ProBellum went out of business. So Sonny Edwards now finally got himself a real promoter who has fighters in his weight class. So the idea is he hasn't fought Sonny Edwards, I'm saying, hasn't fought in a while, hasn't fought since the end of 2022. So it's about a 7-month or so layoff, not a huge layoff, but the idea here is get back in naked defense. And if you win, now we go into a unification fight at the end of the year. So rather than wait to go a year without a fight, get this fight in, shake off whatever roster might be, you know, show the new audience what you can do, because he hasn't really been on the zone or on the Matchroom cards. And after this, there's a very good chance that they will make a fight between Sonny Edwards and Bam Rodriguez in a unification, or possibly against Julio Cesar Martinez for two of the other titles. But the point is, he's going to get one of these bigger fights. That's what Eddie wants to do. And those are good matchups, because they pit the boxer in Sonny, and either if it's Bam or it's Julio Cesar Martinez, they're more of the brawler types. They would probably both be quite pretty appealing fights. So this is his chance to go in there, have a showcase, and you know, we'll see if Campos's 15-0 record, it means anything or not.
All right, we will find out in that one. Matchroom show again, main event, Saturday afternoon in the U.S., Saturday night primetime in London for Sonny Edwards and for that card. All right, then on Sunday, as you've already alluded to a couple of times, and we've talked about leading up to this, the Hall of Fame induction will take place. Timothy Bradley, Carl Froch, Rafael Marquez are all part of it. I know this is a special time. Say a couple more things about it, because the induction ceremony Sunday.
Well, I just love the Hall of Fame inductions. I mean, you know, people like like every boxing fan likes to bitch and moan about this guy should get in, or that woman should get in, or this person doesn't deserve it, whatever. All I know is they got a great class going in on Sunday. I've been to the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies before. I've been to the Hall of Fame many times. I grew up not that far from there. And I would just say to anybody that's listening that's a boxing fan, if you're listening to our podcast, obviously you're a boxing fan, put it on your bucket list. Make it a goal or a plan for some time. It's a nice weather at this time of year. It's a beautiful part of upstate New York. Maybe I'm biased because, like I said, I grew up not too far from there. It's a beautiful part of the country. And take in the Hall of Fame, because you walk through the doors, and it's not a big museum. It's pretty small, and they've got a couple of areas to look at all the exhibits and all that. But if you go on the Hall of Fame weekend, you have the benefit of the weekend plus all the stuff at the museum. It just, I mean, you walk in, the history just flows from that place. You look to your side, there's Sugar Ray Leonard's robe when he was, you know, fighting for the title. There's the hand cast. They make the fist casting of all the great champions when they go to Hall of Fame. There's, you know, the fists of all the great champions. There's Burt Sugar's typewriter. There's, you know, this championship belt, this photograph, that video playing in the corner. Just a remarkable, incredible place. I used to cover high school and college sports in my early days as a sports journalist, and oftentimes would have to travel across New York in the car to go to the western part of the state to cover one of our teams, you know, in a playoff game or something like that. And you just drive straight out the New York State Thruway from where I was working in the Capital District in the Saratoga area. And I would purposely leave early to make my, like, I got to go to Syracuse to cover like a high school football game. And I would leave a little early, and I would make it a point, because the Hall of Fame is literally right off the highway, like a couple hundred yards. You can see it from the highway. And I would go to the Hall of Fame, walk around for like 45 minutes, have a little lunch, or, you know, take a leak, and then get back in the car and head off to my ball game that I got to cover. So I have a long history of devotion and love for the Boxing Hall of Fame way before I was covering boxing. But the latest inductions that take place this weekend, the main event, if you will, are the three modern, in the category they call modern men, and that's great champions. I covered all three of them. They were in some tremendous fights. They're all worthy Hall of Famers. I voted for all three of them, and that's Timothy Bradley Jr., two division world champion at junior welterweight and welterweight. Only loss of his career were to Manny Pacquiao. Carl Froch, former unified champion in the super middleweight division. If you take a look, go on BoxRec, look at Carl Froch's record. Mm-hmm. From the time he fought for his first world title against John Pascal at 168 pounds till the end of his career, which I want to say spanned about 12 fights thereabouts. Literally every single fight he had was like against King Kong, except for one fight he had a little bit of a walkover in a soft touch against Yusef Mack. But every other fight out there was tough, whether it was in the tournament against Mikel Kessler twice, where he split those two fights but avenged the loss, against Andre Ward, obviously a loss in the tournament final. But he also beat Arthur Abraham, and he beat George Groves two times, and he beat Lucien Boutte, a fight I was ringside for. That was a spectacular event where he was the underdog in his hometown, and he scored the knockout to win back one of the titles. I mean, as worthy, him and Bradley are as worthy Hall of Famers as you can get, in my opinion. And you got Rafael Marquez, who was probably most famous for the four-fight series, really three fights, because we talk about the fourth fight the way we talk about Rocky V. Or Star Trek V. We just disavowed that fight. But the first three fights between Rafael Marquez and Israel Vasquez are three of the greatest action fights of boxing ever. kind of underrated. I mean, they're right up there with the level of Barrera, Morales, Gaddy, Ward. I mean, pick an action fight from our times, and it's right up there. So those are what he's most famous for. But he also had a long and distinguished track record as a bantamweight champion, which is really was when he was at his best, actually. He made like 8 or 9 defenses. I think he won all of them by knockout, or most of them by, or I think every one of them by knockout. And he's Juan Manuel Marquez's younger brother. That's not the reason he's in the Hall of Fame, but what it does is it is the not so common occurrence of, you know, two championship brothers in the Boxing Hall of Fame. And Rafael Marquez, by the way, made it to the Hall of Fame by losing his professional debut, if I'm not mistaken, which is not.
You talked about that before, right? Yes, you talked about that before, about overcoming.
You know, that's not the most common thing in the world. So, you know, for him to come back from that and carve himself out a Hall of Fame career, you know, and he's been on the ballot for a few years. This is not a guy, you know, Frotch and Bradley, you know, they're getting in and they've only been on the ballot for a couple of years each, but Marquez has been on for several years. But Rafael, he got stopped in his professional debut and he went on to have a really outstanding career and made some big time, excellent fights. And I'm thrilled for all three of those guys. Like I said, I got to cover all three of them. I've interviewed all of them. You know, I've known Bradley and Frotch in particular, you know, pretty well over the years. Couldn't be happy for those guys. And then, so those are the main attraction, if you will. But then there's so many other deserving candidates that made it in the very, you know, there's other categories. Obviously there's the women's category. You have Alicia Ashley going in, Laura Serrano in the modern women. And then there's also non-participants and there's observers. You've got people like Tim Ryan, one of the great voices of boxing on CBS. Yes. Who I know you and I grew up listening to.
Yes.
With the team of Gil Clancy on CBS for all those years, just a great broadcaster. You got Seth Abraham, who, if you ever grew up watching what I consider the heyday of HBO boxing, which is really like the 80s to like maybe 2000 or, you know, mid 2000s. Seth Abraham was the boss of HBO Sports for most of that time. And he created the tradition, if you will, of the way that HBO was perceived by most people as the behemoth of boxing in the United States and putting on and bankrolling literally the biggest fights that there have been. And he also had a staff that worked for him. I mean, think about the guys that he managed, that he was their boss, who became, you know, superstars in their own right. Lou DiBella, Ross Greenberg, Mark Taffet. I mean, these are all guys that were on his staff. That was a very professional and just extraordinarily talented group of managers and executives that he worked with. But Seth is a great guy, smart, understood what it took to have that cohesiveness. He's the guy that, you know, allowed his people to do their thing. So when Ross Greenberg, who was executive producer, you know, decides, let's put Harold Letterman on, this was groundbreaking. Let's have an actual judge be the unofficial judge. Seth was like, sounds good to me. And he was the one that allowed that to happen. You know, there was a lot of things that they did to innovate the way that we see boxing on television. Because of his position, that's part of the reason
why Box would be another thing. They introduced that with the Kenobios and the technology that now suddenly we have a quantifiable look at how did that round go with punches thrown and punches landed. It came out of the heyday of HBO. There's no
doubt.
And one more interesting thing, at the point in time in which Don King and Seth Abraham got along, that was the World Series of Heavyweight Boxing, remember, from the 1987 and early 88, where they had the undisputed fight eventually, where all the champions eventually fought each other in a semifinal and then a championship, and Tyson eventually won the undisputed championship beating Tony Tucker. That all came about because Don King and Seth Abraham logistically worked it all out with who could fight who.
Well, here's your thing about Seth, and this is why Seth's a real, when I say he's a real man, okay, and this is what I mean by that. In today's boxing business, or any business for that matter, if you've got a guy that's like the moneymaker, that's the star, so to speak, you know, you're going to basically bend over backwards to do whatever you can. Seth Abraham stood up to Don King. And when Don King tried to get Larry Merchant fired from HBO from his commentary position because he was unhappy with his commentary about Mike Tyson, which was totally within the realm of reality. It wasn't like Larry was out on a limb saying the things he was saying about Tyson when his entire career and life were falling apart and he was, you know, acting in a terrible way as a person. And Larry called him out for it. And they basically, you know, King tried to flex him and say, listen, it's either me and Tyson or Larry. And Seth Abraham goes, don't let the fucking door hit you on the way out. And Mike Tyson and Don King left and went to HBO. And at the time, it was like
Showtime.
Oh my God.
They left and went to Showtime.
I mean, they went to Showtime. You know, you just let the biggest heavyweight star and the biggest star in the sport walk out the door. What are you doing? Well, guess what? After Tyson left HBO and went to Showtime. Yes, obviously it was helpful to Showtime. He ended up going to prison and all that, but he came out, he had some big, huge mega events. But after Tyson left HBO, I believe HBO had its greatest days they ever had. That was with the creation of Boxing After Dark. That was in large measure from Lou DiBella, but the type of thing where Seth gave Lou the rope to do it. And they made a ton of good fights. They invested in the smaller weight classes. They increased the number of fights they did. It wasn't just quality, though. It was quantity and quality. And again, Seth is largely responsible for that. So I have nothing but praise for him and what he did at HBO Boxing. Boxing could use more executives like Seth Abram, in my opinion. So that's another guy that's going in who has been on the ballot for a few years, who I have steadfastly voted for. I am thrilled to death that he is in there. I like Seth a lot personally. When I first started at USA Today in 2000, he was nearing the end of his tenure before he left HBO. But I dealt with him quite a bit in those first, in about that first year or so of my time at USA Today. I have kept in touch with him every now and again over the years. Just a smart guy who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I told you about Tim Ryan, and we got the two top ranked guys now going in. Brad Jacobs, who is the behind the scenes guy that basically, you know, figures everything out. He's the one that created their COVID protocols. He's the one that handles all the venue stuff. He handles basically any problem that you could possibly imagine. And he's one of like the only people I've ever known in boxing in my entire career that not only can you not really find people that will say bad about him, if you mention him, they will come out and say nice things about him.
Sure.
That's just the kind of guy that Brad is. He's a diligent worker. He knows his shit. He's highly professional. And it's not just Top Rank's not the only place he's been. He worked for other places. He was the guy that ran Roy Jones's business when he was at the top as a pound for pound king. He was involved with, he cut his teeth in your area in Tampa.
Yes. But
he's also well known for the guy that was essentially the ran the if people remember, if you're a little, our age, maybe not, you know, the younger kids, but the great series Tuesday Night Fights on USA Network.
Yes.
Brad was the guy that booked those fights. He ran that show and traveled the country for, 15 years or so running that show, which was tremendous for boxing. So he's done a lot in the sport. And then, as we talked about last week, my very close personal friend, Brad Goodman, the Top Ranked matchmaker. We don't have to rehash all that, but he's being inducted. It's a well-deserved honor. He, in my opinion, is the best matchmaker in business. And if you take a look at the prospects that Top Rank has developed from the 0-0 out of the amateurs to world championships and stars over the last 20 years, you know why I say that, because Brad Goodman is largely responsible for those decisions of matching those fighters with the guys that they did to get them where they went. So the combination of him and, of course, working with his mentor, the fellow Hall of Famer and also a great matchmaker, Bruce Trampler, Brad has taken his place in Canastota alongside of Bruce Trampler, and it's a great class. And I had not I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the trainer Joe Goosen, who was also being inducted this weekend, has trained plenty of champions, built up the Ruelas brothers from 0-0 at the old club shows that his family promoted in Southern California. Of course, his older brother, Dan Goosen, the late great promoter, and besides being a great trainer, by the way, Joe Goosen went on to have a distinguished career as a broadcaster. You know him from his Fox days, but he also did a lot of the fights on TVKO, HBO, which was the precursor to HBO pay-per-view back in the day. Of course, who could forget, this is just one example of him being in the corner of what I consider the greatest fight of all time, when Diego Corrales made the comeback against Jose Luis Castillo with the classic line, "You better get inside on him now." I mean, it's not quite Angelo Dundee saying you're blowing at some, but it's right up there in my mind. So great class in the Hall of Fame. I'm thrilled for everybody that's getting in, and congratulations to everyone.
Well said. And with all of that, let's get to some news items and then some nostalgia, because speaking of Tyson, we got Tyson Lewis anniversary. We got a Pacquiao Timothy Bradley anniversary, all of that this weekend. My goodness. All right. So on the news front, Eddie Hearn and Matchroom. Hearn's been talking about this in the aftermath of the Sonny Edwards press conference. They're looking to make Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder. But there's a lot of scuttlebutt still that Tyson Fury wants to fight Anthony Joshua before then. All right, so give me a little more on this, because Hearn was going on and on Thursday afternoon about how he doesn't think that Frank Warren and Queensberry are really serious. And he didn't say waste of time, but he was almost implying waste of time, that they're looking instead for Anthony Joshua to fight Deontay Wilder if they can later in the year. Go ahead.
Listen, whatever goes on with Fury, I'm not even going to get into that, because it's so stupid at this point. I mean, the Saudis, they would like to do the mega card with the two big heavyweight fights. Mm-hmm. I think they'd probably still go forward with one of them. And if it happens to be and it's not involving of Tyson Fury, so be it. I mean, you know, I can't figure out Tyson Fury, so forget that. This is about the prospect of Joshua Wilder, a fight that I don't care if it's for a title or not. This is a fight I have wanted to see for years. I would have preferred it to be for the Undisputed Championship when they were both undefeated, and between them they held the three titles. It didn't happen. They tried to make it at the time. You know, both sides, in my opinion, had fault to go there in the different times they tried. But now the discussions are serious. So it's still unclear 100% if Joshua is going to fight in August. They've talked about him doing a rematch with Dillian White. Maybe it will happen. Maybe it won't. Who the heck knows? But there's more of a movement to do the fight, which is a much, much bigger fight, for him to fight Deontay Wilder, both in terms of profile, in terms of money, fan interest, all that. For Joshua and Wilder fight in Saudi Arabia in December. Maybe it would be part of that so-called mega card. Who knows? If they can get the other fight done, great. So what the news of the day, I guess, is that Eddie Hearn is saying, and by the way, today, as we tape this, Thursday, is Eddie Hearn's birthday. So shout out to Eddie,
all right.
Happy birthday. So Eddie was saying that the folks from Skill Challenge Promotions, which are the people that put up the money in Saudi Arabia to bring in some of these big events, like they've done with previous Joshua fights, like they did with Tommy Fury against Jake Paul, et cetera. So that they had sent an offer to him for a Joshua Wilder fight. Not an actual contract, but at least the terms or the basics of it. So he's waiting on a contract, which sounded good to me. Okay, at least that's a start. I mean, you got to start somewhere. Who, you know, it's still a long way from being a signed agreement, obviously. But at least they got the ball rolling. So I wanted to know what's going on the Wilder side. So before we started to tape this, I spoke to Shelley Finkel, who was the manager for Deontay Wilder. And Shelley's perspective was, look, we haven't received an offer yet, certainly not a contract. We'd like to get one. We have been talking to them for a while. We're very interested to do the fight. We want to fight Anthony Joshua. So we're just waiting on them. And it's, you know, the ball is in their court. We're happy to be dealing with them. And we want to make this match. And if in fact, they did send an offer to Joshua, that seems like a good sign. Hopefully, we'll get one soon also. So it seems like both sides, at least what they say publicly, are interested to do the fight. Obviously, there's a ton of details that have to get ironed out. But, you know, and I'm not, and you know me, TJ, I'm not getting too hyped up until everything's done, especially on something this elaborate. But at this moment in time, things are pointing at least in the right direction. I'm not going to get too hyped up. Hopefully, it will happen.
And again, Wilder is also in that category. Jermall Charlo is another one. I mean, how much mothballs? Wilder's fought one round fight with Robert Hellenius in basically 2 years as we approach this fall. So let's get him back in the ring somehow, some way. All right. A couple other news items, then some nostalgia. Errol Spence and Terrence Crawford will start their media tour next week. A little more on that. The hype will begin.
Well, listen, you heard a lot of people say, I think I'll believe it when I see the fight, or at least when there's a press conference. Well, now we have our chance to see the press conference. So this fight is real. The two fighters will embark with their teams and the folks from Showtime and PBC. They will go to two cities starting on Tuesday, where they will be in Los Angeles. Then they will be in, Tuesday, they will be I'm looking at the schedule here. Tuesday, June 13th, they're in Los Angeles for the kickoff press conference. Wednesday, they're in New York City for the second press conference. And then, of course, the two guys will then go back to their training camps. But that's a good thing. They'll meet the media. It's unfortunate they're not open to the public. A lot of times when they do these press tours for the big mega events, they have the ability to have fans there. If they do maybe an outdoor thing, or they put in a big, big place to have fans there to sort of help hype it up, which is always makes it more fun. But the media will be there, and these guys will start to talk about the fight and try to hype it up and make, we oversell things in boxing sometimes. Some things we undersell things. I don't think you can oversell this fight. We talked about it a couple times when they made it. We talked about it after the fact when they finally made the formal announcement. This is as big and significant and historical fight as you can think of in a long time. And this is going to officially kick things off, where we'll start to hear in a meaningful way from the two fighters. You know, they've done a few interviews here and there, but this will be a much more widespread attention. I'm hoping that some mainstream outlets will cover it. Like, it would be a beautiful thing if you could go to a New York press conference and, you know, for the fight of this magnitude, you know, that the New York Post and the Daily News and the New York Times and big outlets like that would cover it. And same goes for when they're in Los Angeles. But it's a huge fight. And this is going to get that drumbeat started. It's going to be about a month and a half before the actual fight, plenty of time. And can't wait to hear what these guys have to say. But what I'm looking forward to the most, TJ, is to get that, you know, the money shot of the two guys nose to nose for the first time once they have a deal. We've seen it before, you know, in more lesser situations, like when they've been at fights, for example. But this is the first time, though. I'm sure they'll be dressed up in a suit nose to nose, and then you get the blood going. Like, I can't wait for this fight.
Let's hope so. Top Rank made it official earlier in the week. Emmanuel Navarrete, Oscar Valdez, Glendale, Arizona for August. We've been talking about that. Now we know it's officially happening. We got some really entertaining fights.
Oh, yeah.
As this summer unfolds.
I think that for a pure fight, as far as action goes, I think Errol Spence and Crawford's going to be a great action fight also because of the way that those guys conduct themselves. But in terms of savagery, pure unmitigated violence, the prospect for a bona fide fight of the year, for drama, for knockdowns, for blood, for all the things that make for a dramatic encounter. I think that Oscar Valdez challenging Emmanuel Navarrete for that 130-pound WBO title has every chance to be a special, special fight. I mean, you never know if it will turn out that way, but if you were looking down the list of contenders and champions in different weight classes, and you said to me or somebody that's knowledgeable about the different top guys in each weight class, said, come up with like your five best action fights. I think you might have, I would definitely have Navarrete against Oscar Valdez on my list because they both have a history of being in great fights. They both want to make a great fight. They both talk about the history. They both invoke the names of Eric Morales and Marco Antonio Barrera. They fight in the same weight class that Morales and Barrera fought in, at least for their third fight. This is going to be a great fight. I mean, if you, you know, I remember one time when Felix Trinidad fought Fernando Vargas, which was, you know, to many people, a fight of the year that year, even ahead of Gaddy Ward one, just an awesome fight. Larry Merchant talked about how if you were like at a restaurant and you were looking at the menu and you try to make the best fight you could, you'd pick Vargas versus Trinidad. Well, I feel like if you had a menu in front of you of fights for action fights and Valdez versus Navarrete was one of them, you'd pick that fight to make a great action fight. So I have huge high hopes for this fight. And again, it's official August 12th, not pay-per-view, regular ESPN. Going to be awesome.
Here, here on that. And Navarrete, again, give him a lot of credit because he's an explosive puncher. He was very active for a while, and he was in a wild fight with the Australian Liam Wilson earlier this year, was down in that fight, got up, was down and was in trouble, got up and won that fight on a TKO, which I think it should be in the conversation. I'm not saying it is, but it should be in the conversation for fight of the year.
It will
because one of the big names for Top Rank in the lower weight classes was clearly in trouble against an underdog Australian that night.
Well, so, don't forget, TJ.
All good stuff.
On the night of that fight against Liam Wilson, it was supposed to be Oscar Valdez in the ring that night for the vacant title, but Oscar was injured, so he was promised the next shot. You know, he came back, had his shake off the rust fight, in a pretty good fight against Adam Lopez in the rematch that took place on the Haney and Lomachenko undercard. And now here we go, Navarrete versus Valdez. It's not happening in February when it was supposed to. Instead, it will happen in August, but so be it.
And real quick, I want to go back to the Spence-Crawford card because you're reporting an undercard fight. This is your reporting, not officially announced yet, but you found out about it real quick?
Yeah, no, I'm told that the co-feature is going to involve Isaac Pitbull Cruz, the lightweight contender, who obviously people know from having the very exciting and somewhat controversial loss by decision. He went 12 with Gervonta Tank Davis back at the end of 2021. He has won two fights by knockout since. He knocked out the remnants of Yuriarkis Gamboa on the previous Errol Spence undercard when Errol fought Ordeniz Ugas. And then he blitzed Eduardo Ramirez in two rounds when Andy Ruiz fought Luis King Kong Ortiz. So he's going to be on this undercard also. And that's a smart move because he brings a different fan base to the table than what you get when you get Spence against Crawford. He'll bring a certain faction of the Mexican and Mexican-American fans. Hopefully they put him in with a solid opponent. I think if he wins, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that when Tank Davis is out of jail and he comes back maybe at the end of the year, maybe we see a rematch between him and Pitbull Cruz. Wouldn't shock me at all. They had such a good first fight and a very close first fight. Isaac Pitbull Cruz, very exciting fighter to watch and a nice addition to this card. It hasn't been officially announced, as you mentioned. And I think what will happen is they'll do the media tour next week and they'll wait and they'll try to get, you know, more attention and they'll wait till like the week after that, probably, or even 2 weeks after that. And then they'll finally announce the undercard. But if he's in with a halfway decent opponent, that's at least a good beginning of what they're going to put together for the rest of that show.
Great stuff. All right, let's wrap it for the final couple of moments here with some nostalgia. Today, Thursday, as we release the podcast overnight, Thursday night into Friday, June 8th, 2002, it was 21 years ago in my hometown. In the arena where my basketball team, my college, the Memphis State Tigers, would always play, the Pyramid in Memphis, which, by the way, Dan Ray, feeling nostalgia, you probably don't know this or realize this. It's not even an arena anymore. It's now a Bass Pro Shops. It's the largest Bass Pro Shop. And I've been in it. It's unbelievable what's in there. In terms of the aquarium, you can stay there. They have hotel accommodations to stay there. Retail clothing, the guns, the different hunting items that they have, fishing items that they have. It's incredible, but it was a boxing arena that night.
Once they built the FedEx Forum, they didn't need it anymore.
That's correct.
But, the pyramid, I did cover a few fights at the pyramid, because not only did Mike Tyson fight Lennox Lewis there, he also fought against Clifford Etienne there, and there was another fight I think I was mm-hmm. out there that escapes me.
A big time magnitude world heavyweight title fight in Memphis in the River City, and you were ringside for Lennox Lewis. We have talked about this before on the podcast. We had been waiting for such a long time, and it finally happened 21 years ago in 2002.
If you think there's problems making Spence Crawford, or you thought there was problems making Pacquiao against Floyd, or any other fight that was a very complicated, difficult, you know, Canelo versus Triple G number one, pick a fight that was the fight that everybody wanted to see, that there was a lot of issues, and it just was like an agonizing soap opera to get to the ring and get to the actual fight. Mike Tyson challenging Lennox Lewis for the heavyweight title was every bit as complicated and difficult as any of those fights, except for maybe Mayweather and Pacquiao. That was in a time when HBO and Showtime were the two dominant forces. They both had each guy under contract. Lennox was with HBO. Tyson was with Showtime. And the late, great Jay Larkin, who ran Showtime Boxing, who I miss every day, uttered the classic line, "Lewis Tyson will happen when pork chops grow on the palm trees of Tel Aviv." He said that quote in the New York Times. And, you know, about a year later, I guess it must have been, or something like that, the fight finally happened. The two networks were able to work out an agreement. And it happened because Lennox went to the bosses at HBO and basically was like, "Look, this is my legacy. I want this fight. I must have mm-hmm. this fight. Please make this for me." Meantime, Tyson was in a situation with Showtime where they had fronted him so many millions of dollars in loans, and they needed to get their money back. They had no other option but to make the fight. So they kind of had no choice but to go and try to make the best deal they could. And but their soap opera to get there, remember, the fight was canceled. It was off because I was there at that press conference that never actually happened when they were going to announce the fight. And Lennox Lewis stood on the stage and Tyson walked across the stage and they ended up in a brawl and Tyson bit Lennox Lewis's leg. And Nevada refused to license mm-hmm. Mike Tyson because of that situation. So he got kicked out of Nevada. They had to delay the fight. Finally, we called it the outlaw fight because Memphis, you know, in Tennessee, which is not the strongest commission in the world, they agreed to, you know, do the fight as, again, I'll quote my good friend Larry Merchant. Memphis wanted an injection of money and a party, and they got both because the town was filled. I was there the entire week. I got there like on a Monday, I think. I had come home from Atlantic City from covering Evander Holyfield against Haseem Rockman on Saturday, did my laundry on Sunday, and went to the airport on Monday and flew to Memphis for the fight. And everybody was there. The whole world turned out. This is how big of a fight that was, TJ. I don't even think people understand it because it is 20 plus years ago. The Tonight Show with Jay Leno was like the big, you know, mm-hmm. after, you know, after the late local news, you know, entertainment sure. show with, you know, the Tonight Show. They had Dave Chappelle, big star. He was hired for the week to be like the quote unquote Tonight Show correspondent. So every day for the week, they would do like these funny bits for the Tonight Show of roaming the streets of Memphis.
I remember that. Yes.
I mean, it was hilarious. So, but that's as mainstream as it gets when I'm trying to explain to you. So at the time that fight set the all-time record for pay-per-view buys and money and gate and the whole nine. And, you know, of its time, it was the biggest fight that there had been in boxing. Now, I never understood why everybody wanted to see Lewis Tyson. Fine. Lennox was still, you know, a formidable heavyweight champion. And even though he only fought one more time after that, at the moment that the fight happened, you knew this is the best heavyweight in the world, bar none. Mike Tyson was already at that point, like, you know, several years past, you know, being a quality heavyweight. But you can't argue. People want to see what they want to see. And everybody knew that era, I always look at it like this. The 70s of George Foreman and Ali and Frazier, they were the linchpins of what I consider the greatest heavyweight era. I'm not the only one that thinks that. Kenny Norton mm-hmm. and plenty of guys that were in that era. But the second best era of heavyweight boxing that ever happened in the history of the sport, in my opinion, is that 1990s. Lewis, Tyson, Holyfield, Mercer, Riddick Bowe, Tommy Morrison, the second coming of George Foreman, Razor Ruddock. I mean, Michael Moore, I may be repeating myself, but mm-hmm. those guys, a ton of them, that made some big, big fights. This was like 2002 when the fight happened. So it was sort of like the end of that era, even though it like lapsed over a little bit into the next decade, if you will. But the thing about it was a huge fight that everybody wanted to see. And when they finally met, that kind of ended the era. And essentially, you knew now between the round robin of Lewis, Holyfield, and Tyson, even though it wasn't all when they were in their primes, that Lennox Lewis emerged as the guy on the King of that mountain.
And he did, because he splatted Mike Tyson. What was your vantage point on that big right hand? Was that coming at you? Were you on the side of it when he splatted him
right
at ringside?
It was right in front of my face.
Wow.
I mean, if you go on my social media, I posted this on Twitter today in terms of the anniversary. So a week after the fight, or, you know, however many days after the fight, the new issue of Sports Illustrated came out. And in Sports Illustrated, following the fight, they did a pretty big spread on the fight because that's how big it was. And so they ran a 2-page spread to like introduce the article. And it's this great shot from overhead of shooting Lennox Lewis with his arm raised into victory. But it's shot from the vantage point that you see into the media section. And on the right-hand side of the second page, you see Rafael, black shirt at the laptop.
I see you. I see the social media picture. Yes,
I got the white towel over my shoulder. And the reason for the white towel over my shoulder is because it was in summer, because it was June, and it was hot as hell in Memphis, Tennessee. And the arena that night in particular was overbearing. I always have a towel in my bag, just you never know when you might need it. And it was so fucking hot in the arena. I had the towel over my shoulder to swab the sweat because everybody was just fucking dripping because it was so hot. And so people can look at it. I was sitting right there pretty much in the second row behind the TV people in the most perfect view you could have of that fight. And Lennox, with that big right hand, put Mike away. And then Mike, as he stated so eloquently after the fight in his interview, that he was going to maybe fade off into Bolivian.
He did fight a few more times, but basically his championship career went.
And Lennox fought just one more time, the fight against. Yep. I'll tell you a funny story about that real quick. I know we're getting along here. At the post-fight press conference on the night that Mike Tyson and Lennox had their fight, I went to the post-fight and I was sitting there, and Lennox had come to the podium. And just by coincidence, I was sitting next to Lennox's mother, his mother, Violet, mm-hmm. who was a very nice lady. I didn't know her well, but I had met her a couple of times and she kind of knew who I was. And so we were just sort of making small talk. Congratulations. He fought a great fight. And he was asked quite a bit at the press conference about, you just climbed the mountain, you beat Tyson, you've beaten Holyfield, you're not a young man anymore, you're going to retire, what do you want to do? And I never forget that Lennox's mom leaned over to me and she whispered in my ear, she says, "I hope he retires." And I'll never forget that. Lennox's mama cool wanted him to retire.
Mama wanted him to fight one more time, right?
So my memory is of his mother, Violet, leaning over to me and telling me at the post-fight press conference, sitting right in front of her son at the dais, that she wanted her boy to retire.
And it is hot in the summertime in Memphis, by the way. I would spend lots of summers in Memphis, and it is commonly very hot. I still remember taking my twins. It's a classic story. This was in early July, not July 4th, but like late June, early July, right around their birthday. We went to the Memphis Zoo. 100 degree day, and with the heat index 112, and the tiger at the zoo's up to his neck in the moat. It can get hot in Memphis, that is for sure. And by the way, one more nostalgia piece, and then I promise we're moving on and we're wrapping it up. My longtime 35-year radio buddy in that market, Dave Woloshin, who's the voice of the Memphis Tigers football and basketball on radio, been a radio personality there since the mid-1980s. He was there that night as you were in the media section. He wasn't as close as you were, with kind of like the overflow local media, TV, radio. And where they were sitting, there were some other accessible seats, and he tells the fantastic story that I will condense now into about 20 seconds, that they're sitting there in the media section the whole night for the undercard, and about 20 minutes before the main event, the Leonardo DiCaprio and the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, and I see you nodding your head, come in and sit down right next to them in the media section about 4 or 5 rows back. And he said everybody everywhere knew who those guys were. And they even struck up a conversation or two with them as the fight was going on, who's winning or whatever. And he overheard DiCaprio saying to Maguire, because Maguire's doing Spider-Man, DiCaprio's got all his big movies, that the plane was already ready for them to be back in L.A. for the party they were going to in L.A. after that fight. And I joked with Wolo, my radio buddy, how did you not sneak a seat on the private plane because you were right by him to get to L.A. to the post-fight party they were flying back to?
Let me tell you, Memphis was wild that week. I mean, it was that they wanted a party and they got one. Yeah. I was staying in a hotel right there off of Beale Street.
Yeah.
And it was loud like 24 hours a day, pretty much. Listen, crazy. Let me tell you, I mean, not that it's the main thing of the nostalgia that we're talking about. Manny Pacquiao was on that undercard, by
yes.
the way. He was recent.
His debut, right? Really on a big time. I'm talking about on a big time fight card or HBO or whatever was that night on the HBO pay-per-view, right?
You're incorrect. His HBO debut was on the undercard of an Oscar De La Hoya fight on pay-per-view. But HBO was so impressed by how he looked when he won the junior featherweight title against Lalo Vadwaba from South Africa that they wanted to bring him back. And because of the situation with making the deal with Showtime, the way that they configured it was, we got the main event. They only did three fights on the pay-per-view. Showtime gets to do one fight. They opted to go with their young guy, Jeff Lacy. And HBO went with Manny Pacquiao. And so you had a Jeff Lacy fight on the undercard on the pay-per-view, Manny Pacquiao, who knocked out Jorge Alicia Julio in defense of his 122 title, and then you went to the main event with Lewis and Tyson.
That's why you are who you are. By the way, say it correctly, that's St. Petersburg, Florida's Jeff Lacy that was on that, and I would never have known that, but the man Rayfield knows these things about that. All right, two more nostalgia items, and we don't have to go a long time on them, but I want to get the dates right, that it's tomorrow, it's Friday as we're taping this. 2007, that's Miguel Cotto knocking out Zab Judah, and you were there. That was part of the Puerto Rican parade, yep. The Puerto Rican weekend in New York that time for that knockout as well, real quick.
This is, in my opinion, this is Miguel Cotto in his dead prime. Remember, he had become a champion at 140 pounds. He had beaten some quality guys there, including Paulie Malignaggi, for example, at Madison Square Garden. He then moved up to welterweight. He defeated and knocked out Carlos Quintana, and he's on a roll. He beats Octay Urcal, who was a good contender in Puerto Rico. That was the time I went to Puerto Rico to see Miguel fight. And then he went on the great run where he had probably arguably his two biggest victories, where he knocked out Judah and he knocked out Shane Mosley. He knocked out Zab Judah. He outpointed Shane Mosley in back-to-back fights at Madison Square Garden. But the Judah fight, because he was fighting another New Yorker, and of course he had the Puerto Rican fans from New York on his side, that was a spectacular event. And I don't know if the record still stands. I'd have to double check. But at the time when he fought Zab, that was the largest crowd to ever be in the building for boxing, maybe ever for anything at that point, in that construction of Madison Square Garden, over 20,000. Like, it was from the rafters they were hanging for that fight. And it was a sensational fight. Zab gave a great account of himself. He obviously got stopped in the 11th round. But Miguel retained that title. He went on to defeat Mosley, Alfonso Gomez, and then net, you know, his Waterloo, if you will, in the first fight against Margarito, where I will go to my grave believing that Margarito cheated with loaded gloves. But the night that he beat Zab Judah to retain the title was a huge event. It was a great performance, a great fight. And, you know, if I said to somebody, you know, what's Miguel Cotto all about? Tell me a couple fights of his I should watch. I would tell you, watch the Ricardo Torres fight, watch the Shane Mosley fight, but definitely make sure you watch that Zab Judah fight.
Love it. And one more piece of nostalgia as well, and we've talked about this frequently as one of the worst decisions, at least in modern times. Timothy Bradley is going into the Hall of Fame. Kudos to him. But it was June the 9th, 2012, 11 years ago on Friday, as we released the podcast. Then you're shaking your head, and I am too. Manny Pacquiao won that fight, speaking of Pac-Man, 10 years after being on the Lewis Tyson undercard. And we've said a lot on that one. Pacquiao subsequently did get revenge and got a decision win after this one. But that was the Bradley victory that night, June 9th of what, 2012?
Yeah, Manny went on and beat him two more times. In fact, the last fight of Timothy's career was the third fight against Manny Pacquiao. So he went officially one win and two losses. The only two losses that Timothy Bradley ever – see, people say, how could you vote for Bradley for the Hall of Fame? Like, you know, he got a gift against Pacquiao. And I try to explain to people, I don't, and I joke around with Bradley about this. He knows this because him and I have had a back and forth about this for years. When I talk about Timothy Bradley as a Hall of Famer, and believe me, I was kind of driving that bus and that advocacy for his election to Hall of Fame. I strongly believe that he belonged in there. I'm glad he got elected finally. But the bottom line is, when I make my case for why Timothy Bradley should be in the Hall of Fame, it's not because he got a bullshit victory against Manny Pacquiao. I don't include that in my reasoning and my rationale why I thought he should be in or why I voted for him. I consider that, in my mind, a distinct loss. But if you take away the fact that his only times he was beaten was by the prime Manny Pacquiao, and he beat everybody else, and he beat a lot of good fighters and unified titles and, you know, won titles in multiple weight classes. So, yes, the Bradley Pacquiao one fight was as controversial as it gets. There may have been worse decisions I have seen. I've discussed Joel Casamayor against Armando Santa Cruz, for example, Jose Armando Santa Cruz, which is the brother of Leo Santa Cruz. So I've seen worse decisions, and there's probably some others I could think of. But bad decisions combined with the magnitude of the event that set off the entire world of losing their fucking minds because of how bad it was, that was this fight. I mean, Bradley didn't barely compete, much less win the fight, and it was just shocking that they gave him. That was as scandalous. That stayed in the headlines for, I mean, think about what the scuttlebutt's been since Lomachenko Haney, which I don't even consider controversial.
Right.
This Pacquiao against Bradley was like a billion times more than that and warranted. That's how disgusting that decision was. So again, when I say Bradley is a worthy Hall of Famer, it's got nothing to do with him getting a so-called victory against Pacquiao. It counts, I guess, officially on the record, but he had beaten guys like Junior Witter overseas, Kendall Holt, Nate Campbell, Lamont Peterson when he was undefeated, Devin Alexander to unify titles, Casamayor, granted an older version, Provodnikov in the fight of the year in a world championship defense, Juan Manuel Marquez, by the way. I mean, he beat a lot of good guys, Jesse Vargas, Brandon Rios, blah, 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 blah. But the Pacquiao fight was horrible, and I'm sorry we have to finish the podcast on that negative nostalgia compared to all the other great fights we talked about. But hey, it is what it is.
He's going in the Hall of Fame. He will have the anniversary of June the 11th, Sunday forever, of going into the Hall of Fame, Timothy Bradley, along with Carl Frosch and
Marquez
and everybody else.
If any of our younger listeners get up in arms and get ticked off about a decision they may see in the future or one that may have seen in the recent past, do yourself a favor and go on your old web browser and Google up, or as my son would say, as your daughters might say, search up Pacquiao Bradley 1. You can read my stories and others that covered the fight. And you want to talk about real controversy? That's real controversy.
Sure.
Not the contrived bullshit about Haney Lomachenko.
And by the way, Pernell Whitaker, Julio Cesar Chavez, Alamo Dome, 1993. Joke, horrible.
But
and a lot of people believe that fight was fixed by Don King. I am saying it on the podcast because King is still promoting. A lot of people still believe that.
As horrible as that is, horrible, no argument. At least they didn't rob Whitaker of his title because it was a draw. He kept the belt because he was the defending champion.
Right, right.
The same way you talk about what happened with Lennox Lewis against Evander Holyfield. They were both champions. It was a draw. Horrible, horrible decision. But they didn't lose their belts. Manny Pacquiao lost the world title in that shit decision. Yeah. That's what was a big part of that controversy. He shouldn't have been a guy that walked in the ring with a world championship and exited without the title.
Busy, busy show. Tons here. And again, the Hall of Fame induction is Sunday after the championship fights, Taylor and Lopez. Again, the Jaime Munguia main event for Golden Boy in California, Sonny Edwards in action earlier in the day, U.S. time in England. We gave you a bunch on this one. My friend, thank you. As I always like to say, make it a point, fight fans, to be with us, because whatever happens, we will be back off the weekend with the Fight Freaks Unite recap podcast right here on this podcast feed. Follow and subscribe. You'll get it right off the weekend for Monday. BetUS Boxing Show will make predictions on these fights for this weekend live 1 Eastern time Friday. Depending on when you're hearing the audio podcast here, find us live 1 Eastern time for the BetUS Boxing Show on YouTube and their platform, Twitter, Twitch. Even if you didn't find it live, find it later in the day or on Saturday from BetUS Boxing. With that, my friend, have a good weekend. Enjoy all the action. We'll recap it off the weekend, Dan Rayfield.
All right, that sounds good.
We are all good here. Thank you for finding us and following us as part of the Big Fight Weekend Podcast Network. We've been previewing it all in the Big Fight Weekend Preview.